Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Pastor Eli James here with William Fink, Greek expert, and Pastor Ken Gregg has called in, said there was a death in the family, and he will not be able to be a participant in tonight's show, so we expect him to join us again next week when we continue this series on Romans. And we had a couple of interruptions, and I think we left off, I drew a line here under Romans 3:12, which is where I believe we left off last time. Is that your recollection, Bill?
I believe so, but I mean, we could go back and recap the first 12 verses if you want.
Well, let's see. Well, actually, let me, let's recap the first six verses because it kind of sets the tone for the rest of the chapter, okay? What advantage then has the Judean, and of course he's talking about the Judahites, not Edomites.
Right.
Yes.
And he makes it clear in Romans 9 later on that that's all he cares about are his brethren according to the flesh in Judea, and Paul knows the distinction.
Right, yeah, and I think he makes that distinction in later on. Actually, I have a quotation from 2 Corinthians that I want to bring in that makes that same distinction, yes. Or what profit is there of circumcision? And, of course, he's, you know, we're only talking about Israelites here, the circumcised and uncircumcised Israelites. We're not talking about any other people here. Verse 2, much every way, chiefly because that to them were committed the oracles of God. Okay, so he's talking about people, he's talking about those Judahites to whom the law and the prophets were delivered. Okay, he's not talking about the Edomites to whom the law and the prophets never had any business. They were the enemies of the Israelites, okay? And they,
right.
they certainly weren't transmitted to the Arabs or the blacks or the Chinese or anybody else. It was only transmitted to Israel. Isn't that how, the context that we have here?
Absolutely. And speaking of the Judeans, he's not only talking about the Judeans in Judea.
Okay.
The Judeans had dispersed themselves already throughout all the cities of Rome, all the ports and major cities of the known world, you know, the Adamic world at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the scriptures existed in Greek, those scriptures were mainly limited in existence to those assembly halls of the Judeans overseas.
Yes, yes, yeah. And so the Judahites who practiced the law were kind of scattered throughout the Middle East. Okay, and living among the dispersion who some of were practicing the law along with the Judahites, but the vast majority of the dispersion wasn't. Isn't that your perception?
Well, yes, I would say that the vast majority of the dispersion were definitely actually true Judahites.
Mm, oh, yeah, they were. Well, some of them were Judahites, but not necessarily practicers of the law.
Oh, no.
Yes.
No, definitely not.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so verse 3, for what if some did not believe? Shall their unbelief make the faith of God without effect? Now, this is an interesting statement here because it contrasts the concept of belief and faith, okay? So the modern faith-only Christian would have to scratch their head at this statement here. What is he saying? Because the faith of God is not something that is a matter of belief or unbelief.
Well, when we get into chapter 4 here, we're going to see exactly how Paul defines this faith.
Yes.
And it's not the way the mainstream churches define it today. And
yes,
even a lot of people in Israel Identity have the mainstream definition of faith in their minds when you mention the word.
Yes.
And faith is not only, faith is the faith of Christ or the faith of God,
mm-hmm,
isn't necessarily limited to the promise of life after death.
Right.
Which is,
yeah,
how most people see it.
Yeah.
The faith of God is that he can effect,
mm-hmm,
everything that he said would,
right,
happen in the Old Testament.
Exactly. Exactly.
And we're going to see that Paul makes a clear illustration of that in Romans, mm-hmm, chapter 4.
So in other words, what Paul was saying in verse 3 here is very similar to what Jesus said, what Yahshua Messiah said, that not one jot or tittle shall pass from the law until all is fulfilled. Because clearly, not all has yet been fulfilled. There's a lot of prophecy and a lot of law fulfillment that has to occur yet before the end.
Absolutely, but yeah. In Paul's perspective, the faith is the belief that Israel will be preserved.
Yes,
that Israel will be redeemed.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the promises to the fathers, as Luke begins his gospel.
Right.
That he
right.
came to fulfill yes. the promises to the fathers.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the faith.
Yeah.
And we have to go back and examine what those promises are.
Right.
And examine how they were fulfilled.
Okay.
And that is Christian faith.
Right. Okay. So the concept of faith is much larger than, but not exclusive of, the law. Isn't that how we're supposed to perceive it? Because all of these oracles, some of them were given by Yahweh unconditionally. Okay, some of the promises are unconditional, but other promises were conditional, that, namely the condition being, we have to obey the law in order for the covenants to be fulfilled.
Well, the promises to Abraham were unconditional,
right.
and we don't have to do anything in order for
right.
the promises
yeah,
to be
Yeah, those certain conditions, right, right.
Right.
Yeah.
And the Levitical law narrowed that, and it was meant mm-hmm. to be temporal, and we'll see that as we go on here, and that was Paul's message in the book of Hebrews.
Right, right.
That it was
yeah.
a specific law of the marriage relationship between Israel and Yahweh that Israel broke.
Yes, exactly.
Was fulfilled mm-hmm. more or less put to an end by Yahshua on the cross.
Right, exactly. However, I want to interject right here, because we can see very clearly in the world today that the conditional promises, the blessings and curses of Deuteronomy chapter 28 are fully in effect because we are not keeping the law.
Absolutely, and Christians have to come to the realization that even though we're not bound by the judgments and the rituals and
yes.
the atonements of the
right.
law anymore, we are to uphold the law. And mm. Paul makes that clear
yes.
that we, being, if we want to be sincere Christians, that we should seek voluntarily to uphold the law.
Right, right. And so it's the difference in perspective, namely the old fashioned, and this would be the Judean perspective of the day. I think we have to fully appreciate the fact that Paul is referring to and speaking to and preaching to those Judeans who were steeped in the oblations and the ritual sacrifices by which their sins were redeemed under the old covenants. Okay?
Right, and you have me getting way ahead of myself in my notes here.
Yeah.
When we get to 3:20,
yeah.
Paul says, since from the rituals of the law, not any flesh will be deemed acceptable in his sight.
Right, right, yeah.
And that shows that the justification is outside of the law.
Mm-hmm.
The law
mm-hmm.
is not required in order for men, the written Hebrew, you know, Levitical law is not required in order for men to be considered rendered righteous.
Well, I mean, isn't that just saying that Yahweh's promises to Israel were unconditional, that
right.
we would be redeemed in spite of ourselves?
Right, but we can't lose sight of the fact that in Romans 3, the topic didn't change just because we got to chapter 3.
Right.
Ever
right.
since the beginning of chapter 2, Paul has been contrasting the Judeans who keep the letter of the law while making sacrifices for atonement and then hypocritically return to their sin,
mm-hmm.
and he's comparing those people to the lost Israelites who, without the law, still know the difference between right and wrong,
right.
and seek to do that which is right.
Yes, exactly. And so,
that was Paul's message in chapter 2, which we discussed.
Right, and the difference there is the attitude under the old covenant was that people were very judgmental of one another and typically very forgiving of their own selves, you know. And then, okay, so you come to the altar and you sacrifice a hog or a goat. I'm sorry, not a hog, a goat or a lamb or what have you. And, so that propitiates your sin. However, the attitude of the Israelites under that system is, you know, the critics rightly call that legalism. And it does not condone or it's not conducive to the Christian brethren or the Judahite brethren loving one another and avoiding, breaking the law out of compassion for one's neighbor. You know, it was very much self-centered. What can I get away with and what can I avoid and what do I have to do to avoid being punished? And that attitude, I think Paul is contrasting to the new covenant, which is based on brotherly love, you know, and coming out, and that's what righteousness is. Righteousness is an attitude of justice, which is contrasted to the attitude of, well, what can I get away with, and how can I avoid punishment? Isn't that what Paul is really trying to get at here?
Right, and you know, we have a correlation. You know, the law leads to legalism.
Yes, it does.
And once you have laws, you have experts popping up.
That's right.
And we know who they are.
Right.
And it leads to all sorts of legalisms. And as Yahshua Christ said, woe to you lawyers,
yes,
who bind all sorts of burdens upon men and lift not one finger to help move
exactly
them.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And we have a direct correlation to our own history of this modern nation.
Yes.
Where when this federal government, this federation of states, and that's probably what it should be,
yes,
was formed, we had relatively few laws on the books.
That's right.
We had relatively few prisons. We had relatively little need for prisons.
Mm-hmm.
We minded our own business. We didn't try to regulate the hell out of each other's lives.
Right.
If you wanted to still in your yard and you're not bothering anybody, what am I to care?
Right.
And with the advent of
big government,
the development of big government
right
in this nation, now we have millions of pages of legislation,
mm-hmm,
and nobody could possibly obey it all. And
right,
we have legalism and a police state and a tyranny in,
yeah,
in order to regulate it.
Yeah, but if some cop sees you disobeying a law you never heard of, they'll throw a book at you.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what we have.
That's right. That's where we're at. It's legalism. That's legalism personified, and we're back to that state. And that's what
we,
I think,
we are again enslaved.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So the law, we have to realize the potential enslavement factor contained in legalism. And so,
right, and the Christian message is to love each other and care for each other and not hassle each other over regular
that's
things.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And the change in attitude, number one, you have to obey the law or practice the law with the compassion for your neighbor in mind, not just worrying about what the punishments might be. And, you know, that's how I contrast, you know, the new covenant with the old covenant. And, you know, it's a change in heart. And, of course, we're talking about the law being written upon our hearts, Jeremiah 31, which is what these legalists, they don't want to have that, because they want to be in control of the society, okay? It's like you say, the lawyers and the judges want to control society, so they don't want people to have self-control. They don't want people to be morally upright for their own sake or for the society's sake. They could care less, really. they want to throw people in jail and act like dictators. That's what they really want, okay? All right, so let me continue. Let me restate number three, because verse three directly reflects upon that. For what if some did not believe? Shall their unbelief make the faith of God without effect? God forbid. Yea, let God be true, but every man a liar, as it is written, that you might be justified in your sayings and might be overcome when you are judged. What's exactly he's saying here?
I'm sorry.
Might be overcome when you are judged. That's very cumbersome.
Well, if you're just in your sayings, if you tell the truth and you're an honest person, you will. And my translation says you will prevail when you are judged.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Be honest and tell the simple truth, and you'll prevail. That's
right.
The way it is.
Right. Yeah. And so then, five and six confirm that attitude, but if our unrighteousness commend the righteousness of God, what shall we say? Is God unrighteous who takes vengeance? I speak as a man. God forbid, for then how shall God judge the world? Okay, so we have to have justice in the world. And for those people, let me just, I just looked in the dictionary before tonight's show. The word righteous is defined as upright, virtuous, morally right or justifiable, the word righteously, in accordance with the laws of justice, and righteousness means rectitude or justice. And all of these words imply a standing code of conduct or law. The word righteousness, as Paul uses it, implies the law. So he does not teach against the law. I think what we're contrasting here, Paul is trying to explain the difference between legalism and true righteousness, which is obeying the law out of your own heart without guile. Wouldn't that be a good way of putting it?
Right. And you know, the Greeks, in the Greek mind, there was two types of righteousness.
Okay.
And there was the things that man esteemed as right, and there were the things that God esteemed as right.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't always the same thing.
Right, they almost never are.
and they must have lifted that straight from the Old Testament prophets, I would think.
Yes.
And it can be demonstrated that a lot of Greek philosophy actually did come from the Old Testament prophets.
Yeah, and that's what Paul actually means in verses 10 and 11. As it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. Of course, that's an exaggeration. People try to be righteous, and they might have, in mind to be righteous, but typically we human beings fall short, especially when legalism comes into play, because it's very obvious that under the legalistic system, people could break the law and actually pay very minor penalties and really not have to worry much about it. And that would be just more excuse to go on sinning.
Right. And actually, this has great, it's profound for this day and age.
Okay.
If you research Paul's statements that there are none righteous, not even one,
mm-hmm.
I have a footnote in my Paul translation saying that this is a quote of Psalms 14:1 and 53:1 and Ecclesiastes 7:20 that
right.
this line is found.
Yes,
and,
yes.
And that Romans 3:10 and 11 are describing the result of the action related at Psalm 13:2 in the Septuagint as translated by Brenton.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh looked down from heaven, or the Lord looked down from heaven, upon the sons of men to see if there were any that understood or sought after God.
Yes.
And that's absolutely
right.
Very scarce thing to find today. So.
Yeah. Well, a lot of anti-Paulists are offended by this statement because, oh, I'm righteous. Don't tell me I'm not righteous. And my response is to that, oh, sure you are. You think too highly of yourself. You know, start thinking, you know, go back to yesterday. What did you do wrong yesterday? And I'll bet they could think of, half a dozen things they did wrong yesterday, you know. And so, again, we're trying to avoid becoming self-righteous, okay? And isn't that what we're talking about here? We're always congratulating ourselves for being righteous, but it's really self-righteousness that we're accomplishing.
Absolutely.
And we're falling short of true righteousness.
Absolutely. Men are quick to justify themselves.
Yes.
And humility is a hard thing to find.
We're all experts at that.
Yes.
All right, let me jump over to verse 13. This is where we left off last time. Their throat is an open sepulcher. With their tongues they have used deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips. Now, he's talking about Israelites here, isn't he?
Right. Well, you know, verse 9 proves that the Greeks Paul talks of were Israel.
Mm-hmm.
How else could the Greeks be guilty of forsaking the Hebrew law?
That's right.
If they weren't Israel.
Right.
And later on in chapter 4 of this very epistle, in verse 15, Paul says, "For the law results in wrath. So where there is no law, neither is there transgression." Well, I never opened my Bible to see that the law was given to anybody but Israel.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right.
And Paul, the Greeks are not the Ionian Greeks, but the majority of Greeks were Dorians and descended from the Danans, and they were Israel.
Mm-hmm.
They were Israelites transplanted at a very early time, and that can be established.
Well, brings up, because I had underlined a passage in 2 Corinthians going from chapter 6 to chapter 7, verse 16 in chapter 6, "And what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God, as God has said, I dwell in them." Speaking only of the Israelites.
Right. Whenever Paul's quoting the Old Testament, one has to go back to see what
yes.
he's talking about. One has to go back to that prophecy.
That's right.
In the Old Testament, because
right.
Paul's not taking it out of context.
And the book of Leviticus was delivered only to Israel and not to the rest of the world, okay?
Absolutely.
"And I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people." There's no universalization here.
That's a prophecy of the redemption of Israel.
Exactly. Verse 17, wherefore came out from among you them, and be separate, or I should say come out from among you, and be you separate. Separate from what? The rest of the world, says the Lord. And touch not the unclean. And this word thing is added, folks.
That word thing doesn't belong there.
That's right.
That word, the subject of this verse, of the touch not the unclean, is the same as the subject of come out from among them.
Yes.
The unclean
them.
Are defined as those people who are not Israelites, and they're unclean because they were not washed. Their sins were not cleansed.
Mm-hmm.
They're wrongdoing, their errors.
Right.
They're unclean. They're mixed races, whatever.
Yes.
They're not clean
so
for many reasons.
He's totally affirming the racial separateness of the Israelites.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And this word thing was added deceitfully in order to imply that this is a neuter unclean.
Right.
That the noun unclean is, well, it should be a noun. The unclean should be a noun, not an adjective of thing.
Well, my translation has it leaves it literally, touch not the unclean.
Right, that's the way it should have been translated. They shouldn't have added that word thing. That's deception.
Absolutely.
And I will receive you.
You know, the King James at least puts the word thing in italics.
Yes.
A lot of Bible translations don't.
Exactly.
And some Bible translations even translate it in a manner which stresses more that they... They're talking about Paul's talking about some inanimate object.
Right. Exactly.
And all you have to do is go back to the prophecy that this was quoted from and read it.
Yeah.
And I believe this might be in Ezekiel, actually. And it's very clear what he's talking about.
Well, what makes the universalists even funnier in interpreting this passage is that, well, I mean, what's an unclean thing? Could it be pork? Aren't they the first ones to tell you? Well, pork is no longer unclean. Well,
right.
There's got to be something unclean.
And actually, my translation, I'm looking at it now, and it says, do not be joined to the impure.
Right.
And I will admit you.
Uh-huh. There
so
you go.
Come out from amongst them and be separated, and do not be joined from the impure. They're both talking about the same thing.
It's talking
it's
about
all
people.
It's the same sentence.
Yeah, talking about people. It's not talking about things, okay? Verse 18, and I will be a father to you, and you shall be my sons and daughters. This is the covenant relation between Yahweh and his people Israel. That's what this is about, folks. There's no spiritualization of this passage possible, says Yahweh Elohim the Almighty. One more verse, chapter 7, verse 1. Having therefore these promises, dearly beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh, which means that filthiness of the flesh is still potential within us, and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. So this idea of once saved, always saved, which has crept into the, you know, it's not in the gospel, but which has crept into the religion, is also disproved by these passages. Okay, so what we're talking about, folks, is we have to be righteous. That means that we have to obey the code of conduct that's been delivered to us, which is the faith of Israel, okay? It's not just mere belief that, oh, I believe in Jesus and I'll be saved. You know, that is so shallow, I can't believe that anyone even believes that stuff, okay?
Well, Paul makes it clear in Hebrews 6:4, for impossible it is, those once being enlightened, both tasting of the heavenly gift and becoming partakers of the Holy Spirit, and tasting of the good word of Yahweh and the powers of the coming age, yet falling away to restore again in repentance.
Yes.
In other words, once you go back to a sinful life, there's no coming back.
Yeah, it's very difficult. Yeah, it's very difficult. Okay. All right, so that was, we paused and did a sidetrack there at verse 13. And I know these passages here, these verses are really jumped on by the anti-Paulians, because it does sound like he is voiding the law in favor of something else, you know. But typically that something else is righteousness, okay? It's not mere faith. And so let's proceed here.
You know, Yahshua Christ came And we're going to talk about this probably at length when we get to Romans chapter 7, but he says he came to fulfill the law.
Right.
And we're going to see what that means.
Yes. Okay. All right. So verse, yeah.
In Romans, however, and in many other places, Paul explains, and we're going to see it coming up here at the end of this chapter, that a Christian should voluntarily seek to uphold that law that our fathers failed.
Yes. That's right. That's right. Okay. Verse 14. Again, we're in chapter 3 of Romans, verse 14, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness, their feet are swift to shed blood, destruction and misery are in their ways, and the way of peace they have not known. So all of these, you know, he's basically quoting these Old Testament passages about the failings of the Israelites. Okay?
Right. Now let me talk something about the quote here itself.
Okay.
Except for a few insignificant variations, all of Romans 3, verses 12 to 18,
uh-huh.
This whole series of quotes from verses 12 to 18, all seven verses,
yes,
are a verbatim quote of Psalm 13 in the Septuagint,
uh-huh.
verse 3.
Okay.
And Psalm 13, 3 in the Septuagint correlates with Psalm 14, 3 in the King James Version.
Yes, I have that noted here, yes. Okay.
But this is a verb. The Greek is, except for a couple
lengthier
of letters, it's exactly like the Greek of the Septuagint,
mm-hmm.
in Psalm 13 in the Septuagint.
Okay.
And that, most of that text of Psalm 13 as it exists in the Septuagint was dropped out of the Masoretic text.
Yeah, I see, because my text here references Psalm 14:3, Psalm 10:7, and it looks like the Septuagint again is longer. Yeah, if there's
right, the Septuagint is much longer in this one Psalm,
mm-hmm.
and the missing part is right here in Romans.
Right, right.
And I even in my own translation notes, I give all the little fragments of which can be found in other psalms.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
However, the whole thing is a verbatim quote of Psalm 13:3 and etc.
Right, right. And so Paul wouldn't be addressing the sinfulness of the Israelites if it didn't have some reference to what he's trying to teach them, okay? So he's not going to reference all these sins committed by the Israelites and then turn around and tell them, well, now you don't have to worry about sinning anymore because the law has been abolished. He's not trying to say that, is he?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
And Paul demands righteousness of his.
Right. And people have the misconception that righteousness is simply some sort of attitude that, you don't have an intention to do wrong. You know, well, we know the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Okay.
Well, you know, the average NAMBLA member swears he's not doing wrong when he's after your four-year-old boy.
That's right. That's right.
And that's but morality is not subjective.
That's right. It's not.
And they would like to believe it is, but it's not.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. So I think in a way, what's the terminology? I'm a psych major, and I can't remember. There's a term for, Do what you think is right, and don't worry about the consequences. As long as you're
that's situational ethics.
Yeah, right. Situation ethics, exactly. And that certainly Paul wouldn't agree with that. You know, there's no possible way he would agree with that.
Absolutely not, because morality is not subjective.
Okay, I see. We have
it's written in black and white.
That's right. That's right. It's not subjective. It's objective, and that's why Yahweh delivered the law and the word to us. Okay. I'm going to recognize Gary in California. Let us go through a couple more verses here. All right, so there is no fear of God before their eyes, and that's pretty much true of the world today, even the majority of Israelites, because the religious world is just sunk in the mire of self-righteousness.
Oh, that's the Church of the Laodiceans, and I can interpret that justly as self-righteous people.
That's right.
What we're in.
That's right. That's right. Verse 19, now we know that what things soever the law says, it says to them who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped and all the world may become guilty before God. Is he arguing against the law here? Some people interpret this verse as being against the law.
No, it's against the people.
Yes.
It's against the pit. We've all failed. We've all failed to be righteous.
Mm-hmm.
None of us are perfect. So because none of us are perfect, none of us have a right to open our mouths.
Okay, and that follows.
Every mouth shall be stopped.
Yeah, in verse 20, the same logic follows. Therefore, by the deeds of the law, there shall no flesh be justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. Now, if the word mere were in, for by the law is merely the knowledge of sin, that would have softened the rhetoric here, because people take the antinomians take this to mean that that's all the law is good for now. It's just to know the sin, but you still don't have to obey the law because the law has been abolished. That's the typical reasoning that these antinomians have regarding these two verses.
Well, you know, back in 2003 when I did my Romans translation, I translated that word knowledge also.
Okay.
But I could just as well today translate it recognition.
Okay.
Through the law is the recognition of error.
Yes.
Of sin.
Yes.
And that's
yes.
True.
Yeah, and we have to have that. And that still applies. You know, clearly, when I read these verses, I was reading them, you know, I've had the criticisms of the anti-Paulists before me, and the misinterpretations of the antinomians before I even read these verses. And I said, now, wait a minute. He's not talking about that. It means, yeah, we have to recognize, we have to understand what the law is. Otherwise, well, as getting back to verse 6, because how in the world could God judge the world if there were no law by which to judge the world? You know, that just doesn't make any sense. So, Gary, you have a comment here?
Yeah, going back I don't know, the first of the chapter around, you were talking, well, Bill was talking about people, and you also, going back, in other words, you had the fruits, and you got to enjoy all these, and then you go back, like the dog with his bark.
Okay.
And that reminded me of what just took place recently. We had a young woman running for Miss America.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she lost it because she agreed with her Christian upbringing, saying that, you know, homosexuality was wrong. I'm paraphrasing what she said. She was asked that question by a practicing Hollywood homosexual who was setting her up. But anyway, she stuck to what she's learned and has enjoyed the fruits of that. Now, later on another talk show, I was listening, and there was people calling in saying, well, I'm a Christian, but, you know, she should have went along with it so she could have got the crown. Well, the issue is this young woman, really young, chose to give up the crown.
Mm-hmm.
You take the real crown, you might
right.
say.
Well, right. That's the clear difference between storing up your treasure in heaven and seeking
mm-hmm.
the things of the world.
Exactly.
And I'm not saying that a young Christian woman should belong in a beauty contest in the first place.
Or what's a homosexual man doing judging women?
Right. And you know, on my I have to advertise my website. On my other website, williamfink.net,
mm-hmm.
on the comments page, I actually lauded this young woman. I actually congratulate her, and
oh, okay.
I made a little thing up, and I actually slammed the sexual deviant.
Right. Very good.
It should be,
yes.
Because what this young lady exampled to me and a lot of other people, and I know that you guys are expressing it, is exactly what a Christian is supposed to be like. You know,
mm-hmm.
like you go back to the Romans.
Yeah, you stand by your principles. Yeah.
Yeah, she just said, you know, if it's going to cost me the crown, then it's going to cost me the crown.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not judging me
yes.
on what I've done for the pageant. You're judging me on my belief in my God and my faith.
Right.
You know, and what she should say down the road is, I didn't know I was up there being judged for my faith.
That's right. That's right. And that's self-righteousness coming from that that homosexual loon in the audience who had no business being there. Absolutely no business being there.
Well, he was one of the judges.
Yes,
yeah,
right.
This wasn't Mr. America. This is Miss America.
Yeah, right.
What's he doing? Well,
it wasn't Mr. Beefcake.
they let this queer get away with this in a sad comment.
Watch your language.
It just in California passed hate law saying even in the churches, it hasn't been signed yet, it's passed the legislature, that even in the churches they cannot talk against homosexuality.
Yeah.
It shows how quickly those people who claim they're Christians compromise their principles.
That's right.
And in the book of Revelations, Yahshua Christ says very plainly, because you are lukewarm, I will spew you out of my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody who claims to be a Christian and compromises his principles is a hypocrite.
That's right.
They're as bad as those Jews Christ was talking about in Matthew chapter 23.
Yes, right.
How can all these so-called Christians, you know, I know a lot of people that have said they were Christians and they voted for Obama when they know that he supports homosexual rights. I mean, even when the baby is out.
He's pro-abortion. He's communist. Yeah.
You
know all these things.
Homosexual rights, abortion, all the things that are satanic, he supports, and yet they voted for him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily would the other guy to be any better, but he never come out outright.
But you see, Gary, the reason they voted for him was to show that they're not racist.
Well, I'm a racist.
That's why they voted for him.
Yahweh is the author of race.
That's right. That's right. Verse 20, therefore by the deeds of the law there shall be no flesh justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. Okay, so, and Patricia just made a comment here. The law is a mirror to show us that our faces are filthy and in need of washing. So we need to have the law in order to know what sin is, okay? Otherwise, how can we be just? Isn't that what verse 20 is saying here?
Right, but in the New Testament, we have the old access to the Old Testament law, don't get me wrong, and we can read it and examine it.
Right.
However, the law is written in our hearts now.
Yes, right. And it should be, and Jesus says his burden is light. It's light for us. It's really not hard to obey the law at all. It's really not difficult. You know, don't lie, cheat, steal, murder, and don't covet your neighbor's booty.
Right. Love my brother, but not physically.
Yeah, of course. And, that stuff is easy. You know, people know when they're doing wrong. Even murderers, even serial killers, they know that the victims aren't enjoying that. They know when they're doing wrong.
You know what's really funny is in Hebrews, it states in Hebrews in 8:8 that the law will be written into our hearts.
Mm-hmm.
That's in Hebrews 8:8, Jeremiah 31:31.
Yes, right.
Okay, around those areas.
Yes.
Now, when it says the law is going to be written into the hearts of Israelites.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have seen people that voted, like we just said, and they have no conscience about it. They said, I said, well, look, he's hiring all kinds of people that are crooks.
Yes.
He's non-whites. They say, so, there's nothing wrong with it. They never got caught. They this and that. I thought you were a Christian. Well, I am, but they use the word but. But's a negative word.
<but. laughs> Right.
And these non-whites or non-Israelites, they don't have any problem with breaking the law.
That's right.
But, it's shown over and over again that we know right and wrong. However, we following over the things of the world rather than the things of Yahweh, we sin again and again. And our fathers sinned again, and it's all over the Old Testament. They saw God, they saw His majesty person to person, basically, in the Exodus, and they still screwed up.
That's right.
And they still followed the mixed multitude and the sinners amongst them.
Yeah.
Into all sorts of error, and they were punished for it.
Right.
And we're
right.
told in Jeremiah 31 that Yahweh would sow the house of Israel and the house of Judah with the seed of man and the seed of beast.
Mm-hmm.
And that's precisely what's happened.
Yes.
And that's a test for us at this end time. And everybody who eats the sour grapes shall die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we're told what that is in the Bible that defines that as the vine of Sodom. And what were they doing?
Right, right.
And that's all pretty clear that it's just a different set of prophecies taking effect.
Yeah.
You said something very interesting there, Bill, and maybe you could explain it, or Pastor Eli, is you said that our new land would be sold with the seed of man
mm-hmm.
and the seed of beast.
I have an explanation on it in depth on my website. It's a paper called The Immigration Problem in Biblical Prophecy.
Because what I'm looking at is man. In other words, the Adamites or the Israelites, the Adamites, would be infiltrated by man. It most likely would be the man that was talked about in Genesis 20. I don't want to get into that.
No. What you're missing is that where does the Israelites in the land are the seed of man?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They're the seed of Adam, and the beasts are the other races.
Right.
Yeah, I understand. I understand that. And you're saying that man there means Adam.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, in other words, Adam would be also, there would be other races out here. I've always thought it was correct that when we first came over here, now I'm changing the subject, I don't want to go too far on this, is that for us to chase the Indians out was correct. Of course,
except that a lot of them there's a lot of evidence that a lot of those so-called Indians may have actually been white people.
Yeah, they were Phoenicians primarily, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The Cherokees and some other tribes down around there, they had blonde hair and blue eyes.
Right.
That's because they were the Israelites left there a thousand years ago.
So it's actually another one of these internecine wars among Israelites. Although I wouldn't go that far to say they're all Israelites, but certainly Phoenicians, they brought a lot of Hebrew script, the Agam script, the Kolbrin script, very similar to Paleo Hebrew. Okay.
Ten Commandments.
Yeah, Ten Commandments. They have these monuments all over the place that are of Israelite Hebrew origin. There's simply no doubt about that. You know, so it's not true that we came over here to exterminate the red man. And most of them were actually primarily white, by their own admission, okay? And, it was an internecine war, but the vast majority of them, died from the diseases that we brought over, And then it was the corporations with their railroad trains and et cetera, et cetera. It wasn't necessarily a race war. It was just another one of these corporate wars,
The Western Plains Indians are surely... of other races.
That's right. That's right.
Most of their DNA is alien.
Yes, yes.
They were extremely hostile to us.
Yes. Yes.
The Eastern tribes, some of them were hostile, but others weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And probably were amalgamated to some degree.
Yes.
I know a lot of guys down south. And I've met over my period of life many guys down south who claim to be part Indian, but I mean you would never dream it in a million years.
Yes,
I saw this Indian. He came out here. He had long blonde hair in a braid, and he had this bandana thing on. I mean, he was dressed like an Indian. He had blue eyes and blonde hair.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he was a biker or something.
Yeah,
right. I went up to him and I made mention to that, and he says,
yes.
"Oh, I'm." Representing my tribe.
Right. Well, the Cherokee are very much aware.
He might be one of these confused New Age turkeys.
Yeah, right.
No, he was saying
New Age turkey.
He said he's Cherokee.
Yeah.
And he says he was full blooded.
Yes.
I said, yeah, but that's when I first learned about it. You have blonde hair, you have blue eyes, you have white skin.
Yeah.
He says, what do you think we all look like, the brown ones or whatever?
Right.
I said, well, yeah. Well, you just learned something, didn't you?
Well, the Cherokee are fully aware of their Hebrew origins. They brag about it, really. Okay.
He was too.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so let's continue here, verse 21. But now the righteousness of God without the law is manifested, being witnessed by the law and the prophets. Okay, what do you make of this verse, Bill?
Well, he was told. We were told that this was going to happen, that Israel was going to be cast off,
mm-hmm.
and that Israel was going to be justified and rendered righteous and decided to be righteous by Yahshua Christ sacrificing atonement
mm-hmm.
on the cross.
Yes, yes.
And that's what Paul's talking about, the
yes.
righteousness of the law in the prophets.
Yes.
And he tells the Romans over and over again that they are descended
yes.
from these Israelites.
Well, now, isn't he also trying to tell them that their sins have been forgiven and that they need to acknowledge this?
Right,
as
absolutely.
Israel.
That's all all part of this message. It's amalgamated into the message.
Yes. Okay. So
and that's what the good news of the gospel is.
That's right. That's
the only
good news.
Good news of the gospel is that Israel has been redeemed.
Yes.
And that Israel should now return to Yahweh. Because Yahweh died on the cross,
yes.
Israel is now able to return to Yahweh.
Right, there you go.
He could not take back an adulterous wife by the law. It's in Deuteronomy. It's explicit.
Right, so even if they were following the law in their own form of righteousness, that still wouldn't be enough because, as he said earlier, we all fall short anyway. So we've been redeemed by the forgiveness.
Right. Well, something I'm hoping to illustrate in a few minutes here is the fact that, you know, Ishmael was circumcised.
Yeah.
But he was still told to get lost.
Right. Exactly.
I wanted to ask a question of both you guys. When Yeshua had the wife, you know, Yahweh, how many wives did he have?
Well, I don't know. You want to answer that, Bill?
He
married, although the verse doesn't say married when we accepted the law at Sinai, that language of marriage and divorce, I take it more figuratively, but I don't recall.
Well, the prophets didn't. The prophets made it explicit.
Okay, but what are you asking, that more than one wife?
Well, the reason I'm asking that question is I know some Israelites, you know, identity, that state that, you know, God is for polygamy, you know, many wives.
Oh, okay.
And I've stated to some of these that Jesus only had one wife.
Okay, yes, Israel, yes.
Yeah, now, if it was polygamy, he could have had, the Edomites and the Canaanites.
Okay, I think I understand where you're going with this. In other words, if the church replaces Israel, then Yahweh's a polygamist.
Well, Gary, I have a paper about that too, called The Divorce Discourse. That's also on my website.
Well, I think that the church would be for those when you guys just went through the thing about how you had to die before you could be remarried.
Mm-hmm.
So Yahweh had to die, which he did, because Jesus Christ is, I consider Yahweh.
Okay.
And so he died in the flesh. And he rose again in the flesh.
Mm-hmm.
He died and he come back. And when he comes back, now he gets to marry those that he divorced.
Right, it still is.
Because he followed the law.
Right.
So it's still the same bride. Okay, it's still the same Israel. Everything's still the same.
Yes.
What I'm trying to blow out of the water is that he set the example of how many wives you can have.
Okay. Well, I don't know about that. But certainly there's no other bride other than Israel. You know, I mean, there's no suggestion here that some dispensational church replaces Israel in the flesh. Wouldn't that be accurate, Bill? There's no suggestion.
Oh, the dispensational church dispenses with half the Bible.
Right. Okay.
That's not just the Old Testament half. That's half the New Testament.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and they take the rest out of context. All right.
Absolutely.
I'm gonna say, y'all bless you guys. Can you listen to you guys on the radio so I don't interfere and break up your life?
All right. Thanks, Gary. Okay.
Yeah, bless.
All right. Verse 22. Even the righteousness of God, which is by faith of Jesus Christ, to all and upon all them that believe, for there is no difference. Let me say the next verse because it's explanatory. For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. In other words, he's saying the Judahites who practiced the Old Testament law and the dispersed who weren't practicing it, we have all fallen short, and there's no difference between us because of that. Isn't that
right?
What you're
no man can ever claim that he is righteous because he of his behavior.
Yeah. Okay.
Because none of us, not one man, can actually make a legitimate claim to having perfect behavior all of his life.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Okay. Verse 24, being justified freely by his grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. Now I know most Bible scholars prefer the word favor in place of the word grace. What's your comment on that?
I don't use the word grace.
Okay.
I use the word favor.
Okay.
And it, I think it more stresses the intent of Yahweh's favor towards the children of Israel.
Right.
And grace is a church word I try to avoid.
Right. And favor actually is exclusive in its meaning. Okay. He's favored one group over another group. Okay. And the word grace does not convey that at all. Okay. So the word favor is the correct translation. Grace is one of those another broad generalizations that the universalists try to impose upon the New Testament. Okay, verse 25, whom God has set forth to be a propitiation through faith in his blood to declare his righteousness for the remission of the sins that are past through the forbearance of God. Now, I know I referenced this verse, I think, when we were discussing Hebrews.
Oh, yes, I'd like to discuss this verse.
Yeah, go ahead.
Now, my translation doesn't translate as past sins. The verb is proginomahi. I translate it forthcoming sins.
Okay.
And there's reasons for that that are doctrinal, and this is where interpretation often interferes with a translation or is necessary to make a translation.
Okay.
And that's just the way it is, and I can be criticized for my translation of this, and I'll accept that. However, let me explain it, and my notes to my Paul translation do explain it.
Yes. Okay.
Pro-giganotone is the perfect active genitive plural participle of proginomahi, which is to come forwards, to be born before, to exist before, former, things of old time, but also to come into view.
Okay.
And it's often used by Greek writers to refer to things that are past, but it's also used of things to come into view.
Okay.
And I would say that it's more or less a matter of doctrine to understand that the errors to be committed by the children of Adam throughout the age were foreknown by Yahweh.
Sure.
And I could cite Romans 9, 10 to 13, and Esau was hated from the womb, or Matthew 18, 7, in order to support that.
Mm-hmm.
Although not in the sense of being pre-approved.
Right.
Okay? Now, literally, in this sense, this I would translate this more literally than forthcoming, which is what my translation says, but I could stand by that.
Mm-hmm.
It can be sins having come into sight.
Okay.
But that does not necessarily, and that's a very literal translation of the word.
Okay.
But that doesn't necessarily denote past sins, since something having come into sight may well still be on the horizon.
Okay, well, how about the word acknowledged, sins that are acknowledged? Because coming into sight is something that you have to acknowledge, right?
Well,
wouldn't that be a good translation?
Well, yeah, that would also work, but it doesn't,
it's not
it
as literal.
Starts from the literal sense of the verb.
Right. Well, why don't you read us your translation of verse 25?
Whom Yahweh set forth as a propitiation through faith in his blood for a display of his justice by means of the pretermission of forthcoming errors, or forthcoming sins.
Okay.
And in other words, we wouldn't be having all of the sin that we have in the world today if Adam didn't fall in the first place.
Right.
And all sin was foreseen upon that occurrence.
Okay.
Now, I will admit that my translation is based on my doctrine.
Yes.
And you can't translate the New Testament without having occurrences of that.
Certainly, yeah, and that's
not
what we.
Possible.
Yeah, and what we're trying to bring out is the editorial process that the King James Version has gone through. In many cases, very blatant and very erroneous, and that's what we're trying to get at. Yeah. So there's no such thing as a translation that isn't subject to some type of editorial process.
Right, and this is one of those verses where I could admit that I put this under editorial process.
Okay.
But to me, this is the correct view is demonstrated by the mere fact that, Paul and the other apostles were preaching repentance and forgiveness to people who weren't even of age at the time of the crucifixion.
Okay.
Yeah, that sinned after the crucifixion.
Right.
And they were forgiven on the cross.
Right. Right, yeah.
So that's why I translated forthcoming.
Yeah.
It's Yahweh conceived his appearance on earth as a man at the fall of Adam.
Right. And there's no doubt that we are still subject to and beneficiaries of the forbearance of Yahweh. If we weren't, we'd be in big trouble because all of our sins would be on our heads every day. Okay. All right. So verse 26, to declare, I say at this time, his righteousness, and righteousness means justice, folks. And there's no type of justice that doesn't have a set of principles or laws, that he might be just and the justifier of him which believes in Jesus. Now, of course, he's tying this tremendously to Yahshua Christ, that if we don't believe that he came to redeem us, if we don't, in that sense, if we aren't Christians, and I think this applies to, you know, there are some in identity who follow the Old Testament and don't actually, from what I gather, they don't accept Jesus Christ's propitiation for them. Isn't that what he's saying here?
Right, and every Christian says, oh, I believe in Jesus.
Yes.
And when you ask him to define that,
right,
then they have a serious problem.
Yes, exactly.
and even when they're able to express a definition, it's nothing like the faith of Yahshua,
mm-hmm,
that we find,
yes,
in the Bible, in,
right,
Scripture.
That's right. They don't believe in a biblical Jesus. They believe in the Jesus of their personal whim.
Right,
that's,
and most of them, that Jesus is in the arms of a young, pretty young virgin.
That's right.
It's a little baby in the arms of a pretty young,
yeah,
virgin,
right,
and they're,
exactly,
really lusting after the virgin.
Well, yeah, or I mean, they have this, they lust after innocence, let's say, okay, because I don't attribute any kind of bad intent to most of these Christians who have this, I'll just be honest, childish view of what Jesus is, okay, but you know, they don't, you know, they want to be innocent, but they don't want to have to obey any laws in order to be declared innocent. They just want to be given it. They just want it to be given to them, and it's not that simple.
Right, but you know, that's the fault of the seminaries and the pastors that they're,
yes,
seminaries are turned,
yeah,
out.
Well, they're teaching this once saved always saved BS, you know. And that certainly Paul doesn't agree with that.
But every Christian has access to a Bible now, too.
Yes.
It's not like it was back,
there's
in
no
the 1300s.
There's no excuse, he says, in other places. You have no excuse. The law is right here before you, folks, so you have no excuse in becoming a sinner. Okay. Verse 27, where is boasting then? It is excluded by what law of works? Nay, but by the law of faith. What's he saying here in verse 27?
Well, and the reason to boast is excluded. In,
okay,
other words, no one can boast that they're just or righteous.
Right.
It's excluded by the faith that we've all done wrong, but Yahshua,
okay,
Christ has absolved our errors through his sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And not through it can't be excluded through a lot of rituals.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, I sacrifice my sheep Sunday. I'm a free man. I'm good. I'm
right,
going to be in heaven.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Or even more generally, I obeyed this law and that law, and therefore I'm great. Of course, he hasn't been tested yet. Okay, verse 28. Therefore, we conclude that a man is justified by faith without the deeds of the law. Now, isn't he just talking about the redemption at the cross here? That,
well,
not that the law is no longer in effect.
The rituals of the law,
mm-hmm,
and a man is justified by faith without the rituals of the law. Abraham wasn't given a law to conduct any rituals when he was deemed righteous,
mm-hmm,
and he was deemed righteous before he,
right,
he was told to, you know, to begin the circumcision practice.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
His,
okay,
righteousness was found aside from that. So that's the example Paul was trying to make.
Yes. Okay. So righteousness, therefore, it says the deeds of the law, and I know you want to translate that from the, because it's the same expression from the Septuagint, the,
right,
rituals of the law.
The rituals of the law, the atoning sacrifices and,
yes,
everything that we're commanded to do by the law,
right,
even though that was put in place to govern the nation at that time,
yes, okay,
as part of Yahweh's agreement with the children of Israel, that by itself does not make a man just or righteous, or it's not good enough.
Right, right. Well, plus there's also things that Yahweh expects us to do that are not part of the written code of the law, such as loving our neighbors. It's implied in
absolutely
the law.
Loving thy brother is not part of the law.
Mm-hmm.
Love and mercy are not part of the law.
They're not part of the written
mercy
law.
Mercy isn't part of the law. The law is simply, you do this, you die.
Right.
You do this, you pay.
Yeah, exactly.
You do this, whatever.
Yeah, right.
And that's it. It's very black and white. It's a lot like like the legislation we find today.
Yeah, right. And that's why Jesus said, I give you a new commandment. It's not really a new commandment. He says, love one another, okay? He puts it in that term, I give you a new commandment. But that's implied in the law. We just haven't been living up to it.
Well, if Christians think about it, put the law aside,
mm-hmm.
and look at the Ten Commandments only,
okay.
right? And the commands the apostles added to that in Acts chapter 15,
okay.
because the Greeks didn't understand the concept of adultery the way the Hebrews did,
mm-hmm.
they had to add fornication to it.
Ah, okay.
Okay.
All right.
That command, and that's why they added it, and I could make an exposition of that.
Interesting. Okay.
Okay. So they added fornication, and they told them to keep away from foods, from animals that were strangled.
Yeah.
And that was a thing of custom.
Yeah.
And the Greeks and the Romans would eat anything.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. They're like modern Christians.
Right. Exactly.
Exactly.
Right. So. So basically, when you keep the Ten Commandments and those simple precepts that the apostles added,
mm-hmm.
and that was because of the change in culture that had to be added.
Yes.
And the loving your brother, you can't break a law.
Mm-hmm.
You can't break one Levitical or Deuteronomic law.
Yes.
If you obey those
right.
10 things with the few additional precepts we find in the New Testament.
Yeah, and have an attitude of love and compassion toward your brothers and neighbors. You know, if you have that, you're very unlikely. I mean, certainly accidents are going to happen, but even there, if an accident happens, you take responsibility for it. That's tough. That's real tough.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you have to have that kind of love. And where does faith come in? Well, when you sacrifice, if you accidentally run over your neighbor's cat, okay, and they say, well, you owe me a cat, but you can never replace my dear, whatever name they gave that cat, obviously you can't replace the cat they had,
I could come up with a good Jewish argument and say that God must not have wanted you to have that cat that you were isolating
right.
anymore.
Exactly.
So now it's dead, and you lost it, and that's tough.
Right, right. And so the actual punishment in the old law is, well, you replaced the cat. Okay? Now, if you deliberately kill the cat, you have to provide two. you double the penalty, And so, we have to have the trust and faith in Yahweh that when we do that, we will be likewise rewarded for our faith. Okay? And the people who practiced the law in the Old Covenant didn't have that consciousness that Yahweh would reward them for being, just
right,
with their fellows.
I sincerely believe that over the course of learning of the history of our race, that
mm-hmm.
all of that was set up by Yahweh ahead of time.
Yes.
And he would know that we would fail, and he would know that in itself wasn't good enough in the first place.
Right, right, yeah. Because since the law wasn't in our hearts and we were just practicing legalism all that time, it just wasn't working. It just wasn't working, And I think this is what Paul is trying to get across to these people and to these modern Christians who aren't reading this thoroughly enough to understand what he's really trying to tell them, that, we have all fallen short, even though we pat ourselves on the back tremendously whenever we get a chance, okay? All right, so where were we? Okay, verse 27, by the law of faith. Now, that's kind of an interesting construction. Is that justified in this context? What is the law of faith?
Well, I have no, but through a law of faith. In other words, with faith, that's all the law you need.
Okay.
Because faith brings obedience.
Okay.
Paul's idea
yes.
of faith, remember, includes
yes.
obedience.
Okay.
Where James, in his writing sees them as two different distinct things.
Okay, yes, yes.
Paul's epistles show over and over again that obedience is a built-in part of his conception of faith.
Right, right. And then I believe it was Hebrews chapter 10, the faith chapter, where he talks about how he defines faith, and none of those definitions exclude the law, none of them. Okay, yeah, so we went over that in great detail. Okay,
well,
so,
Christians today, they have James's idea of faith.
Okay.
And works is not a part of it.
Right.
And then they
right.
don't do the works.
Yeah. And so, yeah, and there's a lot of people define faith as practice.
And that's the way Paul defines it.
That's right.
Faith,
yeah, faith and
practice
go together. There is no practice without faith. There's
you
no
can't
faith
claim
without
to
practice.
Have faith without the works.
That's right. Right. And that's what James is trying to get across. And for Paul, that concept is built into the word faith. Yes, I get you. Okay. All right, verse 28. Therefore, we conclude that a man is justified by faith without the deeds of the law. Okay. And so is he just reiterating here?
Well,
about
he's justified by faith apart from the rituals of the law.
Right.
That's his conclusion throughout all of this. That's
okay.
Right. It's only a repeat of what he's already explained.
Yes. Okay. So verse 29 and the punchline at verse 31 is absolutely fantastic. Verse 29, is he the God of the Judeans only, or the God of the Judahites only? Is he not also of the dispersed? Yes, of the dispersed also. Isn't that what he's trying to
right.
tell us?
Right, and here the word is ethnos in its nations, and it yes. means the dispersed nations of Israel.
Sure.
Paul's already told the Romans over and over again, and we're going to slam that home in the next chapter,
okay.
that they're the descendants of the Israelites.
That's right, that's right. Seeing it is one God which shall justify the circumcision by faith and the uncircumcision through faith. And, of course, the circumcision is the Judeans, and the uncircumcision is the dispersed.
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay, so verse 31. Do we then make void the law through faith? God forbid. Yea, we establish the law. Okay, so anybody who thinks that he was arguing that the law is no longer in effect is disproved by verse 31. So, Bill, what's going on in this chapter? How is it that the antinomians and universalists have got this notion that that Paul is arguing that the law is no longer in effect, we don't have to think about it or worry about it, and faith takes its place?
I don't know how they missed this one, and that's what there's no explanation.
Okay.
There's no explanation. Rather, we establish the law.
Mm-hmm.
We establish the law, but our justification is not dependent on it.
Okay.
But we should seek to establish it.
Right,
to
yeah.
To practice it.
Yes.
To make it a part of our lives,
mm-hmm.
that we're going to do right by each other. We're going to do good deeds for each other.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to not chase false gods, not disrespect our parents, all the things in the Ten Commandments, and Christ sums it all up in one commandment, to love one another as yourselves.
Good. Well, now, this word justify and the noun justification, what does that really mean? Because it sounds like, you know, I think most people interpret it as meaning that everything I've done has been, I've been declared innocent of my past sins, or even some upcoming sins, but that somehow I've been validated. You know, I think most people interpret justify as validation. How are we validated by this gospel?
Well, we're validated by our own behavior.
Okay.
Which is how Abraham was. Abraham was a righteous, just
yes.
man.
Yes.
Justice, it's dikaios is the word.
Mm-hmm.
And in Homer and early Greek writers, it's, and I'm quoting Little and Scott, of persons, observant of custom and social rule.
Okay.
Well-ordered.
Okay.
Civilized.
Okay.
observant of right, righteous, in accordance with right, of things even, well-balanced, regular, exact, rigid.
It's
also right or lawful,
mm-hmm.
just, as
okay.
opposed to adikon, which is lawlessness or unrighteous, you know, injustice.
Yes, yes.
And it's society that defines what's
yeah.
right and what's wrong. As a rule, in the world, there's two kinds of law in the Greek mind.
Okay.
There is nomos, and that's the law of the land, because
okay.
nomos originally meant a pasture.
Okay.
And then there is ethos, and ethos is the law of the people.
Okay.
And the word is related to ethnos, which is a nation or a race.
Right, right.
And
yeah.
and that's in
the customs and laws of the people of the nation. Yeah.
Right, and this is in the secular Greek word, and you know, the secular Greek mind, but in the Hebrew mind, there's only one law, and that's from Yahweh.
That's right.
And to be righteous, you have to be righteous. You know, there's two types of righteousness in,
mm-hmm.
in the Greek mind, too.
Mm-hmm.
And dikaios is also righteousness as perceived by men, as opposed to the
mm-hmm.
word hosios,
yes.
which is righteousness as perceived by God.
Yeah. yeah.
And hosios is often translated holy in the King James.
Right, right.
And that really means a righteousness as righteousness is esteemed by God.
Yeah, so... I think the picture I'm getting here is that a lot of the universalists and antinomians, they sort of overlook the meaning of the word righteous and righteousness.
Right.
And,
they want to gloss it over, and,
yeah.
and they probably really can't define the word if they want to.
Yeah, exactly. They have glossed it over and sort of ignored it because it is a reference to actual laws and customs which must be observed and cannot be ignored.
Right, but it's systematic theology.
Mm-hmm.
It's systematic atheology.
Okay, atheology. Right.
There's a whole group of words in the New Testament, and it's Gentile is the most glaringly
yes.
blatant, but grace
mm-hmm.
and righteousness and several other words
yeah,
which
even
Christians
faith.
Really can't define.
Right.
And when they're self-defined, well, that leads you right into situational ethics.
Right.
And a morality that's very subjective.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
And very poorly defined. That's
yeah.
the way it is. And we're conquered often through our language.
Yes, exactly. They're using words that have no proper or clear definitions, even in their own minds. But they have a feeling and a tradition associated with these words, which are more reflective of their religion than any definitions they have of the words, okay? So in other words, it's just a feeling. It's a feel-good Christianity which has taken the place of law, of lawfulness and righteousness.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Of true righteousness, right?
Yes, true righteousness.
Truly correctly defined righteousness.
Exactly. Which... boy, if you can get people to define their words, the words that they're using, and then I think you mentioned it earlier, when you ask them, well, what's your definition, many of them couldn't even define it for you.
Deer in the headlights.
Yeah.
That's
what's faith? How do you define faith? Did Abraham prepare to sacrifice Isaac because there was a law that said you have to sacrifice your son? There was no such law.
Absolutely not. And,
yeah.
and Paul defines faith for us in every word of Yahshua Christ. I mean,
okay.
it's in 1 Timothy 6:1-4.
Yeah. yeah, so we
and,
have
and
to...
And he defines faith right there as a belief in every word
mm-hmm.
of Yahshua Christ.
Every
not
teaching.
Not just the picture of the virgin with the baby.
Yes, yes, yes. The teaching, which is, if you love me, obey my commandments. Okay. All right, our chapter 4, verse 1. What shall we say then, Abraham, that Abraham, our father, as pertaining to the flesh, has found? Okay, Abraham, our father, as pertaining to the flesh. Any spiritual Israel talk here?
Well, absolutely not. and no, no, no. This is better because the Textus Receptus has Abraham, our father.
Uh-huh.
All right?
Yes.
But... And the Codex Bazai, which is a 5th century codex, which has more variations from the other codices than mm-hmm. any other.
Okay.
Okay, the Codex Bazai is out there.
Okay.
And that's generally called D among scholars.
Okay.
But the text of the Codex Sinaiticus and Vaticanus and even the Codex Alexandrinus and Ephraim Syri, the Alexandrian textual tradition, has Abraham, our forefather,
mm-hmm.
and that to me is much more explicit.
Yes.
That's not a spiritual father.
Right.
Okay, that's our forefather Abraham. That's a genetic father, and there's no doubt about that.
Right. And,
okay,
but it says, and as pertaining to the flesh.
Paul is telling the Romans
mm-hmm.
that Abraham is their forefather.
That's
too.
Right, exactly. Yeah, he's not telling them that he was their spiritual father.
Right, absolutely not. This is right. Our forefather Abraham, just as Paul told the Galatians in Galatians 4:28,
mm-hmm.
and we, brethren, down through Isaac, are children of the promise, and,
yes.
in contrast with Ishmael.
Yes.
And just as Paul told the Corinthians, all our fathers were under the cloud and all had passed through the sea, he's telling the Romans.
Mm-hmm.
So we see that the Galatians, the Corinthians, and the Romans are all Israelites of the dispersion.
Yes.
It's Christian duty to examine history and examine the archaeology that's available to us now to find out the truth of these matters.
Yes.
This
yes.
truth is only told, the true New Testament is only taught in Christian
Israel right.
identity, and that only the two seed line variation.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yes, yeah, so, and right after the word father, it says, as pertaining to the flesh, how can that possibly be misinterpreted? That he's talking about his literal forefather, Abraham, our literal forefather, okay? So verse 2, for if Abraham were justified by works, he has whereof to glory, but not before God. Again, the King James mystifies me in many cases. Let me just read the third verse here. For what says the scripture? Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him for righteousness. What are these two verses telling us here?
Well, the faith of Abraham is the faith of Abraham is that the promise of God that his seed would become many nations and that he would be rewarded, and that's the faith of Abraham.
Okay.
Abraham believed that those promises were going to come true.
Right. Yeah, and he believed God. And that, and that's part of our problem as Israelites. We don't believe God when he makes promises to us.
They read the book, and they don't believe it.
That's right.
And it says a man that lays with a man shall die, and they call themselves Christians.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yes. So we have to learn to have faith and trust in Yahweh, because you know, when he tells us he's going to do something, it's going to happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's what you know, Abraham was told, look, you're in the land, you know, in Haran. He was told, pack up and leave. And he packed up and left.
Yeah.
He didn't argue.
Right.
And that's the faith of Abraham.
Yeah, and there was no law in the books that said that you must all pack up your stuff and leave.
Right. He left the homeland of his fathers. He left his family.
Yes.
He brought several men with him.
Yes.
You know, the Christian mind in the modern
oh, he brought his
mind,
household with him, yes.
Right. They picture Abraham alone with Sarah and a donkey.
Right.
And that's not the way it was.
Right. Yeah, just like Joseph and Mary.
Right.
Okay. All right, so righteousness, again, Justice, you believe Yahweh, and there are numerous statements in the Old Testament and the New Testament which are statements of faith which are not part of the law. And so you have to make a distinction between those two categories, okay, and count them as. So when Yahweh told Abraham to pack up and go to Canaan, okay, then, he may have had his doubts, but okay, I trust you, Yahweh, this is what you want me to do, that's what I'm going to do. Now, but of course, our people like to argue with God. They like to argue with Yahweh and say, I don't want to do that, why should I do that?
Right, and that's not what it says. That can't be what it means.
Yes, exactly. They don't trust the Bible. They don't trust the word of Yahweh.
No, and if, you know, I challenge people all the time that if you claim to have a faith is a belief.
Mm-hmm.
And the word, the Greek word pistis basically means belief.
Okay.
And it's translated faith very often.
Yes.
And I do so myself. But I do so in my translations. I have explanations for most of my rendering.
Right.
For those, you know, church-type words in my notes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's reasons why I translated faith, but it means belief. It's a persuasion, a belief that something is true. That is faith.
Yeah. Okay.
And whether or not you've seen it, that's the way we should accept the word.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a belief It has to be founded on something.
Right.
There has to be a reason why you believe it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you pry at most Christians,
right,
you'll find that they profess a faith that's really founded on nothing.
Yes.
or on very little.
Right, right, right. Well, you constantly have to test yourself, and, you know, when you do righteous works, you have to have the faith that you will be rewarded thereby. Okay, isn't that what he's saying in verse 4? Let me read verse 4. Now to him that works is the reward not reckoned of grace, but of debt. Let me go into verse 5. But to him that works not, but believes on him that justifies the ungodly, his faith is counted for righteousness. What's he saying in these two verses here?
Well, to justify the ungodly, you know, the Israel is the ungodly, and they were justified.
Okay.
And that's
by favor, yeah, by grace.
Absolutely.
By redemption, yes.
And basically, that's the point Paul's trying to make.
Okay.
It's that.
So, in other words, you have to believe Yahweh that when Yahshua sacrificed himself on the cross for us, that really happened. That's the good news. You have to take this seriously and believe it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Otherwise, you're still living under the old ritual law. And
yes,
it ain't going to help you out.
Or you're still chasing the false gods.
Right, right, okay.
And most Christians today are still chasing the false gods.
Mm-hmm, okay. Even as David also describes the blessedness of the man to whom God imputes righteousness without works. In other words, we should be willing to accept this, and the word imputes is kind of, it says credits or transfers here. I guess credits is a good word. Let me read again with that substitution. Even as David also describes the blessedness of the man to whom God credits righteousness without works. In other words, we were freely given this credit even though we didn't deserve it. Or is there more being said here?
Well, it's true to look at it that way, but it goes on to say, blessed are they who are released from their lawless deeds.
Okay,
whose
yes.
Errors are covered.
Yes, okay.
And in faith, we have to know that the minor mistakes that we make in life, and I say minor, they're minor compared to the unforgivable sin, say, of blasphemy of the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, or murder
and
or things like that, which our people rarely do. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing, you see the Pharisees, they chastised Christ for breaking the least of the laws or
mm-hmm.
in their own perception. They were micromanaging the people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't constantly. And yeah. That's the contrast that Paul's still making here, that we all fail on points of the law constantly.
Mm-hmm.
However, because we're basically attempting to follow God and stay faithful, that he's going to forgive all those little sins.
Right, right. And so in verse 8, blessed is the man to whom Yahweh will not impute sin.
Right.
Yeah.
But there are sins that are unforgivable.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh surely will.
Right, exactly. Because otherwise, how could he judge the world?
Right.
Going back to chapter 3. Okay.
Right. Well, that's the dichotomy, the apparent dichotomy. People always confront me and say, well, what about a serial killer? And what about this guy and that guy? You know, Charles Manson or
yes.
Picking out famous criminals in history, Theodore Bundy.
Yes.
Because they may well be Israelites.
Mm-hmm.
And well, will their sins be forgiven? Yeah, their sins will be forgiven eventually.
Eventually.
And they're set up as an example for us and what to do and what not to do. And that's clear that they had a purpose in our history, and even though that may not be manifest right now, eventually one day it will be manifest to us
yeah.
why people like that exist. And I'm not going to try to explain the unexplainable.
Yeah. Well, even,
but
yeah,
people of general faith and belief in Yahweh will not be held accountable for their errors. Paul says that
right.
some men send their sins to the judgment beforehand
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
in Timothy. And if you're repentant and trustful in Yahweh and have a belief and a general tendency to follow his will or at least to want to do so, you're not going to be accounted all of your sin won't be imputed to you. And that's
right.
what he's saying.
Yeah, well,
David was a man after Yahweh's own heart, and mm-hmm. look at what he did with Bathsheba and Uriah the Hittite,
right?
Who wasn't necessarily a Hittite,
okay.
by race,
right?
And that can be expounded upon too.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, because they were among the Phoenicians, and the Phoenicians were primarily Israelites, but there were some.
The word Hittite is also an epithet for a mighty warrior.
Okay.
And
yeah.
we see that Uriah was a great soldier.
Right. Right.
And that Hittite, if the epithet, and this can be seen right in Strong's Concordance,
mm-hmm.
if the epithet mighty warrior is used one time of a man in the Bible, Uriah would be deserving of it.
Mm-hmm.
David sent him into the battle on the front lines, knowing that eventually he'd get killed. But Uriah must have been a Hittite, meaning a mighty warrior, because that's exactly what he did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, let me just go one more verse here for today. Comes this blessedness then upon the circumcision only? And that's what the circumcision would believe. Okay, the Judeans would believe that only would come for them. Or upon the uncircumcision also, for we say that faith was reckoned to Abraham for righteousness. And isn't he just trying to drive home the point here that they are Israelites of the uncircumcision, and therefore their faith counts too?
Well, absolutely. As we saw in Romans chapter 2, the Romans, they were never given the law.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
The Romans, their descendants, Judah, Zarah, and we discussed this, they're going to be amongst those who are cleansed outside the law.
Right, right.
Okay, they are the wild olive tree that has to be grafted back
mm-hmm.
in.
I was just going to ask you about grafting, because I think isn't there a scientific principle that if you graft a branch of one type of tree onto another tree, that it actually bears the fruit of the original tree is from, not the fruit that it's grafted onto? I'm not sure about that.
I honestly don't think so, because
okay.
several years ago, my mother, and I honestly wouldn't have approved of this, but she did it.
Yes.
She went and bought an apple tree.
Okay.
And this apple tree is, well, fittingly, it hasn't produced an apple yet.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and I tell her that's what she gets for buying this kind of tree.
Right.
It's actually four main stems, you know, branches, and three of them were grafted in.
Really?
And,
oh, wow.
And it's actually four varieties of apples on one tree.
Amazing. You bought the tree like this?
She bought it like that. Don't blame her on me.
Okay. All right, yeah.
Yeah, she bought this tree, and it's four varieties of apples, and they told her it would produce apples. But it
yeah, but it's four,
apples,
it's four varieties.
It's been about
interesting.
3 years, 4 years now. And,
yes.
And yeah, the branch will continue to produce the fruit originally of the tree that it came from.
Yes, yes.
The trunk is only maintaining, you know, bringing fluids to the branch.
Right, right, yeah. So in other words, that you cannot grafting other races.
Well, you know, I know the King James translates the words good olive tree and bad olive tree.
Right.
And that's not what it means. It's a wild olive tree and a cultivated olive tree.
Okay, there you go.
And
there you go.
Both olive trees.
Yes. And,
we're not talking about grafting fig trees and
right.
pear trees.
And the olive tree is symbolic of the Israelites.
Well, the wild olive tree is symbolic of the Judah Zarahites
yes.
who departed from Egypt,
yes.
were never given the law at Sinai.
Right.
And still, as Paul explains in Romans chapter 2, grew up into a law-abiding, governed by the rule of law nation,
mm-hmm.
which the Republic of Rome was.
Yes.
And the empire degenerated, but all empires degenerate.
That's right.
And that's the natural course of the politics and the governing of
yes.
man.
Exactly, exactly.
And look at America has turned into a degenerate empire.
That's right.
In 200 short years, we started out as a righteous republic.
That's right.
Well, the history of
Rome, like
Rome. is very much the same exact history.
Yes, yes.
It's the growth of a nation to become mighty and imperial.
Yes.
To start race mixing and folding in people of alien blood into its fold.
Mm-hmm.
then to degenerate as an empire and become a tyranny.
Yeah, and that term, that terminology of being grafted in is always interpreted by the universalists as meaning, you know, see, a person of any race can become a Christian.
Right, but to not understand history is to not understand
the Bible.
Paul tells them throughout the book of Romans that they're Israelites.
Yes.
And knowing that they're Zarah Judah, and knowing that they departed from Egypt and never were given the law at Sinai,
mm-hmm.
and went to Troy and had several hundred years of Troy, and eventually ended up in Rome in Italy and founded the Roman Republic right about 750 BC, about the same time that Isaiah started writing.
Right, and I forget which passage it is, but doesn't he say grafted back in, as if they were actually a branch that kind of fell off the tree and had to be grafted back on? Not a totally strange tree or a totally strange branch?
I don't recall that precisely.
Okay.
I'd have to go look at my translation.
Yeah, well, maybe we can cover that next time. But certainly Paul understood that the Romans were of Israelite heritage. They were, as you say, Zarah Judah, but they were outside the fold because they left before the Exodus and never partook of the...
When you compare all of Paul's epistles, he doesn't talk to the Corinthians, the Ephesians, or any of those other people about needing to be grafted in.
Right.
He talks to those people about redemption, under the law.
Right.
And the marriage and divorce thing. And he talks to the Romans about that, too. But he talks to the others about reconciliation and a whole lot of other things that he doesn't mention to the Romans.
Right.
However, he tells the Corinthians, all our fathers were under the clouds. They were given the law. Those people had the law. Their ancestors went through Mount Sinai. They went through the Exodus. They experienced the kingdom under the Judges period.
Yes.
Or under David's period, under the reign of the king,
mm-hmm.
depending on when they had emigrated.
Yes.
And they were caught up in that history, and they had that codification of ethics handed down to them from generation to generation. And even though they forgot why, they are part of that national fabric that the people that left from Egypt were not a part of.
Mm-hmm.
The Romans' ancestors didn't have that experience.
Right.
They were the wild olive tree.
Exactly. And that's what the wild olive.
They were still Israelites.
That's right.
They're still olives.
That's right. Okay. We have to know the symbolism of our history, of our people, folks. Okay. Very good. All right. Let me just quickly announce, because we have set a date for our Paul of Tarsus, or Saul. Let's call it a Saul-Paul conference, okay, for now, until we actually come up with an official title, on June 20th in Binghamton, New York, okay? So anybody interested in participating in that, Bill and I, and we'll see how many other speakers, maybe one or two others, to talk about what is Paul really trying to teach our people. Is he an exclusivist, as we maintain, or is he a denier of Christ, as the Paul bashers insist, okay? And so I'm working on a document called The Exoneration of Paul, which is basically going to address the translational problems that we come up with, and how the anti-Paul, how two groups of people, namely the mainstream evangelicals who interpret Paul as saying the law has been abolished, and the gospel can be universalized. I'll be arguing against that. Plus also the Paul bashers who accept those false interpretations, okay, and make them their own and bash Paul because of them, okay? So that'll be, the thrust of my presentation. And I don't know if you've had a chance to think about what you're going to be doing, Bill. Do you have any ideas?
Well, I'll make an outline, but I'll make an elucidation in the Bible that Paul's mission was to the nations of dispersed Israel.
Okay.
And that Paul was the glue that stuck Christianity
uh-huh.
to lost Israel.
Okay.
And the Paul bashers can point to no one else who did that.
Right.
And Paul taught also two-seed-line Christian identity.
Yes. Okay.
And he was the first two-seed-line Christian identity teacher.
Right. There you go.
He just didn't call it that.
Right.
But it's evident in his epistles over and over again.
Yeah, and even in Book of Revelation, I forget which chapter, it says, I believe it's chapter 6, And then they will teach, as it were, or sing, as it were, a new song. And it says, as it were, because Christian identity is actually the same old religion.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's the old religion, but since so many Christians have abandoned the old religion and come up with all kinds of fabricated nonsense, it says, as it were. Okay, it will seem like it's a new song, but it really is the same old. We're the ones preaching the old-time religion, and mainstream Christianity is not. They're all modernists.
Right. Well, if we can get the Paul Bashers to the seminar, I would like to display that two-seed-line Christian identity and Paul have absolutely no differences whatsoever.
Right. Great. Okay.
It's only their own lack of understanding and their own insistence on the mainstream lies that they slam Paul for no reason.
Exactly. Okay, so that's kind of a preview of what this Paul conference is about, ladies and gentlemen. It should be very exciting, and I'm very much looking forward to it. Again, that will be on June 20th, and we haven't set a time yet. I'll wait for some feedback. You know, if there's people traveling long distances, we might want to give them a few hours driving time, maybe 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Maybe go for 4 hours at the most, something like that, okay? And then maybe have dinner afterwards for those who want to do that, okay? So that should be a lot of fun. Looking very much forward to that. Okay, Bill, I think we're doing Romans, the book of Romans, a great justice here, trying to understand what Paul is really getting at, and that he's not trying to lead people away from Christ. he's at most, at the very most, maybe he makes some preacher mistakes, of exuberance. He's actually a preacher in many cases, and sometimes, you may overstate a case or exaggerate here and there, but he's certainly not preaching a different gospel from Jesus Christ. That's a stretch.
Right, and I wouldn't even accuse him of making preacher mistakes.
Okay.
Because we tend to examine what we have from Paul with great scrutiny,
mm-hmm.
and some people are very critical of it.
Yes.
However, this is a man with a 30-year mission, or about 28 years, I think, was his ministry, and we only have 14 epistles.
Right. Yeah.
And we don't have all of the – we don't have a fraction of what he wrote.
Yes. And
1 Corinthians is clearly at least his second epistle to the Corinthians.
Right.
And he even talks in 1 Corinthians about having written to them before.
And plus, we're also dealing with a translation of his work, which, you always have to cut a guy some slack when, if I write something in English and it's translated into German or Russian or Czech, I can't be held responsible for the translation.
Right. But basically it boils down to the fact that if the Paul Bashers were scrutinized at the same extent that they scrutinized Paul,
exactly.
They're all guilty.
Yeah, exactly. 40 lashes times 400.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. Okay, all right. Bill, thank you very much. It's been a fun show. Looking forward to getting more into Chapter 4 of Romans next Saturday night. And tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen, my guest will be Pastor George Udvari, and we're going to be talking about the feast days and why the feast days, they're still applicable to true Christian Israel. They're in the sense of a memorial. We don't have to, obey the rituals necessarily, but these feast days were commanded to us as a memorial forever. The Bible says that very plainly. So we're not to forget these feast days. So we're going to be talking about those tomorrow, and praise Yahweh, and have a good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Bye-bye.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh.